So, the floor is open for response and discussion and questions. John?
About the relationship of eggs to poverty, I wonder if there isn't a similar relation for tuberculosis.
There is, and I think it's complicated. It's one of the things that is complicated by the whole consensus about AIDS, that the World Health Organization actually has described tuberculosis as an AIDS disease. We know that AIDS is not a disease, although it's spoken of very glibly as a disease, it's a syndrome. That AIDS human is a person which exposes people to the risk of infectious diseases. And it's been a serious problem that where there is a rise of tuberculosis around the world, it's estimated that maybe a third to half of the people in the world are infected by it. But the reason that you get it, as opposed to being infected by bacillus, is in fact related to poverty. There are many diseases like that. There's a difference, for example, between hookworm infection and hookworm disease. You get hookworm, but the disease is caused by anemia and loss of iron, which is what happens when you take in less iron than the hookworm takes out of you. It's the same thing with tuberculosis. You can be a carrier, but you don't get the disease. But because it's been called an AIDS disease, people are not looking as much as they should at the relationship with poverty. But in areas like England, there have been recent studies that show that it is not related to AIDS at all, and it is directly related to poverty, to overcrowding, to poor diet, even today in parts of London, much as it was 100 years ago in late Victorian England. Yeah.
I have a serious problem with the statement that there is no evidence that HIV is causing AIDS. And I'm thinking why. The point is, I think there is evidence for biospecific antibodies and so on. Now, if I understand well the criticism that is directed against medicalization approaches, against technical approaches of Western type medical support science, which is
hard,
and saying, stressing the factors of poverty, of factor adjustment, and all the things that have been done. I can agree with that, but I do not understand why is it necessary to combine this with questioning the relationship between HIV and AIDS. Why is it necessary to doubt or to question that AIDS is sexually transmitted? I think it is totally true that that a lot of these diseases, like tuberculosis or malaria or whatever, is intimately related to poverty. And you would say, if I say that malaria is for a big part of the disease which is related to poverty, I don't say at the same time that malaria is not caused by Plasmodium falciparum or Plasmodium whatsoever.
Well, but I didn't say that. There are numerous problems. One is, I think, the triumph of the germ theory, which had great merit in its time. But there were very powerful reasons why the idea of a single disease entity having a single pathogenic origin came to the fore in the way it did. The medical historian, the U.S. medical historian Charles Rosenberg, back in the 1960s, pointed out that most diseases are a combination of a biological process and a social construct. And if you look at the interpretation of diseases for the last 100 years, at least, you can see that that plays a very strong role. The whole discussion of the epidemiology of cholera has a large part to play. It's not to say that there may not be an identifiable pathogenic agent in many cases of disease causation, but that exposure to it does not mean that you become ill. That's the critical thing. So that, but let me give you an example. The more that we pursue our investigations into a whole variety of diseases, in the area where AIDS is prevalent in, say, Uganda and Kenya, going back to the late 1950s, there was a discovery of a form of cancer found largely in young children called Burkitt's lymphoma. people did not know for a long time what seemed to be the cause. And then, because of laboratory research in England, they implicated something called the Epstein-Barr virus, which is also known to be the cause of mononucleosis. It then turned out that you very often had a close association of Epstein-Barr virus with Burkitt's lymphoma, but that you also had a very strong correlation with the prevalence of endemic malaria. But you also, it turned out, had instances where there was Burkitt's lymphoma in the absence of malaria and Epstein-Barr virus. And so 30 years on, in a recent journal article indicate that the epidemiology of Burkitt's lymphoma is still highly problematical, and even the issue of poverty and malnutrition comes into the picture. The first argument that I'm making is that a more holistic, processual approach to disease has been lost through this process of technicalization. Right? That by looking at the questions, the contradictions of the HIV-AIDS model, we begin to illuminate certain of the limitations of a purely technicalized scientific view of disease. I think that's the first thing. And part of it has to do with some of the things we've been talking about, is how people get trained to be scientists, how you lock certain problems of disease causation into certain kinds of boxes. And I gave the example of pellagra because there were many imperatives, social, political, and economic imperatives, why even after Goldberger demonstrated that pellagra was a deficiency, not just the fact that the dominant disease paradigm of the day was that there had to be a pathogen, but because there were very conservative social forces at work that preferred the implications of a pathogen to those of a deficiency disease related to low-wage employment and exploitative labor conditions. One can talk about that in many instances. I think the problem about, you asked the question about sexual transmission of HIV and AIDS. I think the real question is, why is everybody so resistant to the idea that it may not be a sexually transmitted disease? And where does the idea that it's a sexually transmitted disease come from in the first place? First of all, the disease was first noted in San Francisco among the gay population there, at a time when gays' behavior was becoming more public, more overt, more conspicuous, coming out of the closet. And the rise in certain diseases, like Kaposi sarcoma, which is now not, by the way, regarded as an AIDS disease, but at that time was the clinical symptom that alerted people to something going on, seemed to signal that it was a sexually transmitted disease because it was a population it was occurring among that was defined in terms of its sexuality. Then people looked to Africa in the early 1980s when the first cases of AIDS came to the fore, and people said, well, AIDS is occurring in Africa, two or three cases in Kenya, two or three cases in Uganda, but we know about the hypersexuality of Africans because that was part of the colonialist legacy that previously attributed African underdevelopment to overpopulation. Africa was overpopulated because Africans didn't limit their fertility because they had this promiscuous behavioral sexual behavior. So everybody said AIDS is sexually transmitted disease, Africans are hypersexual, there will be an explosion of AIDS in Africa. The recent consensus is, if you look at the work of Gisselquist and others that I refer to, is that surveying the literature, is that the relationship between sexual behavior and HIV prevalence is simply not there. They, however, subscribe to the idea that HIV is the cause of AIDS. They simply say we've got to find another connection because sex won't do it. Now, what I think is part of the problem is, if you take a disease like tuberculosis, which is on the rise, and like the World Health Organization, you say that it's an AIDS disease, what do you do to intervene to the degree that tuberculosis is preventable and treatable disease? You say, tuberculosis is an AIDS disease. AIDS is caused by HIV infection. HIV infection is sexually transmitted, so we can prevent people getting tuberculosis by giving them condoms. What, to put over their heads so nobody coughs in their face? It's just not going to work. It's a form of reductionism, and it has actually made preventable deaths recur. Just as happened with pellagra in the American South in the 1920s, 15 or 20 years after we knew how to prevent it, because of the germ theory's prevalence, people still died. And I would say that that's still happening. Why the resistance? Peter Duisberg, who has argued, he's the world's leading expert on retroviruses, one of the world's leading cancer specialists. If you read his journal articles in peer-reviewed journals, the man is not part of the lunatic fringe, but he's been put there by conventional science, because conventional science, normative science, does not allow for dissonance. It does not allow for heterodoxy. And there are profound reasons, and we ought to explore why that's the case. And it has to do with the fact that science has been professionalized within the political economy of capitalism. I give you a good example. If you look at the internet, you will find that within the space of about 20 or 30 years, 11 researchers at Bell Laboratories won Nobel Prizes. Hey, that's great. Nobel Prizes are good. But 11 were won by Bell Laboratories. We are increasingly concentrating our scientific enterprise in places that are run by major corporations who, however much imaginatively they let people do research, at the end of the day, gauge what work will be done by its commercial benefits. Whether it's Arnold Penzias doing work with radio telescopes to determine whether you can measure the Big Bang, or it's people like William Schottky doing work on radio transistors, it is still about profit. And people like Peter Duisberg, with dissident and heterodox opinions, have been marginalized from sources of federal funding. And all they're asking is a couple of $100,000, not to get on the AIDS bandwagon, but to be able to come up with a testable hypothesis, and nobody wants to let him do it. What are they afraid of?
Well,
thanks,
sir. Any counters on that? Anyone there? Okay, go on, Rob.
I think to say that many people have died because of Thabo Mbeki's statement is a gross exaggeration. I don't think that's why they're dying.
I'm only saying that many people do that in South Africa. They say that. I don't think they are there that would be right. I know that many people are very angry about that. Now, the point is, and I can, in a way, understand, if we at the moment, my problem is to separate the, I agree totally with you. Statements in what they're saying and the connection between the certain medical approach and capitalism. That's a disaster. And I totally agree with that. But say, using that argument at the moment in a situation with a very high prevalence of HIV is used at the same time as confusing people in the sense that they say, what if it's not sexually transmitted? So, no protection for the necessary. And I think this would be a very disastrous consequence. Because we are not.
I'm sorry, you're trying to say that one should not raise the alternative explanation that it's not a sexually transmitted disease because of what? Because if I'm wrong, there are untoward consequences. What I'm saying is that you can put as many condoms on people as you want, and you may still get AIDS, and that's unconscionable as well.
Yeah, I had some additional speakers there.
Thank you. I was just thinking of what I hear are different discourses at different levels of different interpretations of science, and I don't think they are necessarily incompatible. I rather see them as complementary. And I think your story is right, and Eric's story has value as well. I can't judge entirely the validity of each of the discourses because I'm not an expert in the field, but assuming that both are valid, I think we are looking at two different discourses at two different levels, and they both have a valuable function in determining how people will be behaving. So my proposal would be actually in that case, if that happens to be the case, if they both are valid, why can't we live with two different discourses?
My remark about tuberculosis as the connection of poverty with tuberculosis as being analogous to AIDS was made because in the case of tuberculosis, I suppose it's acknowledged that the tuberculosis bacillus discovered by Koch is at least one of the causes of the disease. You may have the bacillus, but not the disease. But the other predisposing factor is poverty, malnutrition, bad living conditions, coal, as in the Russian prisons. So isn't there an analogy there with AIDS where the retrovirus is there as one of the causative factors and the other predisposing factors may have to do with malnutrition and poverty?
Well, it's interesting. As I said, the evidence is very widespread. UNICEF has underscored the point. Is that hundreds of millions of people in the world suffered from compromised immune systems because of poverty and malnutrition, not because of HIV. If many of those people also have HIV infection, it is not a cofactor. It is, in the words of Peter Duisberg, a harmless passenger virus. It has been seen, it is correlated, but is, as the title of one of his earlier articles was, correlation is not causality. I would like to argue that at the time that people were beginning to see single causative pathogens causing individual disease entities, Koch's postulates were not an argument about an endorsement of one disease, one cause. They were a precautionary method to make sure that every time you found something in tissue or whatever, you did not jump to the conclusion that correlation immediately meant cause. And that's been one of the problems. But it was the starting point of Duisberg's initial arguments, is that Koch's postulates are actually something that should be respected, because they prevent you from jumping overboard. Peter is not a man who does that. He was the discoverer of the first oncogene. As soon as he discovered a gene that caused a cancer, everybody jumped on a bandwagon, and he got off. Okay? Because science does not proceed by jumping on bandwagons, except for the fact that the Center for Disease Control and the National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health, in fact, create bandwagons, because that's the nature of the American political economy. After all, it's a society in which we invest more per capita annually on healthcare than they do in many other countries, including Cuba, and we have far more people who have no decent healthcare. Why? Because most of the money goes to third parties, to pharmaceutical companies, to health insurers, to other things. It's that kind of economy that everybody's getting a piece of the action, and by the time you see what resources are left to actually solve the problem, you wonder whether solving the problem was part of the agenda. So,
thanks.
Sorry.
Just made me think my reading of what I heard was led me to the scientific mind. Meaning that in our group, we were thinking of critical thinking and the possibility of trying to encourage critical thinking, that is also subjecting everything to doubt. So without entering the technical field, the specialistic field, although I think we do know that there are concomitant causes to determine an epidemic of the dimensions of HIV and so on. It's not just the disease, it's also the environmental conditions and the social conditions. But what I was thinking is we've been hearing what politics can do with a bit of science. So science is very much on the political agenda, can be used and misused for instance, moralistic purposes, as well as social outcasting or marking with the mark of licentiousness and so on and so forth. So this is, I was thinking, what are the possible remedies and the possible tools for the sorts of making the scientific mind right to for the benefit of the humanity rather than for this. I know it's an enormous question, of course, but it made me think of an immediate, we were thinking of possible examples or applications. Well, this is, for instance, one. But there is a myth of science also, which is used consciously or unconsciously for everybody who is not a scientist. And we are all subject to the myth of science. We accept what science says through the media. We were talking about the myth. And this is the other aspect of this sort of scientific mind question. So, only this.
This statement is a response to Dr. Ross's comment. I'm kind of not surprised, just saying. In any nature where you have a paradigm shift, you're always going, or at least trying to make a paradigm shift. You are always going to get people who are going to the less green, but people kind of believe, always not accepting the idea. So it's not really surprising in that way. It's not even surprising that when something happens that everybody goes on a bandwagon. In fact, it's a good way, the hypothesis out there is a good way of gathering evidence from as many views as you can possibly can. And you're right in that we get blinded by it because it happens to everybody moves one way and you stop to think that there might be alternative ways. And again, everybody wants to capitalize on it, you know, pharmaceutical industry, the healthcare system, everybody. But then it's also not a bad thing because it's the way the society works. But what I'm a little bit surprised by is the tone of the presentation. It was more of a negative tone of everything about capitalism is wrong. There's something about that that alternative means that you propose is the right word. It may not be, but it's a hypothesis out there for people to stop and say, look, you're all going one way. Have you ever stopped and thought that maybe you have to go the other way? I know it's always very difficult. I've always been in an area where I have always gone upstream against many forces. It's been very hard to get funding, exactly as you say, very hard to refuse to look at something because they don't want to see this anymore because they want to go with mainstream. We don't want to sound like a sound great that we didn't get funded. What we really want to do is say, guys, stop for a moment. Think back. Maybe there are alternative explanations. Maybe you need to gather more evidence. I like your ideas, but I would like to not be presented as there are devils out there and we are good guys, but presented saying we are human beings. Capitalism and North American society, as much as you want to attack, that's fine, but there are good things about some things, there are good things about other societies, and you know, just the tone of the presentation is just a little bit up for me, but I like the ideas and I think provocative ideas are always challenging and it's great.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I mean, there is a reason for being slightly critical of capitalism. I think that a number of years ago, I came across an article by somebody at the World Bank who said, this was about 15 years ago, you have people who are wasting away, and you say, is this person dying of malnutrition or dying of AIDS? And they say, well, you give them an AIDS test, and if they're HIV positive, then you know they're dying of AIDS, not malnutrition. And there was an agenda being set by the World Bank, who, in fact, very few people, it's like a case of ledger domain of watching the magician doing a show, and you're looking at the left hand, and the right hand is where it's all happening, is that structural adjustment has not come under kind of attack. And I felt when Peter Duisberg came here, I invited him to actually come here to talk with an audience of development specialists instead of the normal scientific conferences he was used to. And also because I felt that people in the field of development who talk rather glibly about HIV/AIDS needed to hear somebody offer a different approach, because they were getting their science pre-fed, pre-packaged, off the shelf, without the questioning around the edges. And I preface what Peter said, because he's not a development specialist, by a little bit of an introduction about why I thought that AIDS was a development issue. Because I think that people are dying. And that is what prompts me to be so concerned. I think people are dying, and we're blaming it on a retrovirus instead of looking at things like third world debt. Okay. If I have a conference here about third world debt, I brought people from Jubilee 2000 to talk about the need for debt relief. None of the economists in this institution showed up. This is one of the problems we have. So I just felt that the World Bank, the IMF, the privileged institutions, the OECD countries with their policies, the international banks that have helped third world countries run up these debts, U.S. foreign policymakers who pushed up U.S. interest rates so that small debts became big debts, so that third world countries like Kenya don't even have a health budget. So the countries, in fact, that were making great headways in the early years after independence in terms of meeting their healthcare needs for their populations, are now seeing 40, 50, 60% of the people living below the nutritional poverty line. Nobody was talking about those issues. The World Bank was saying that the main cause of underdevelopment in Africa is AIDS, and making it sound as if the answer was sexual behavior, and if you didn't have that, then Africa would have a great surge of development. And I felt that was criminal. So I do tend to get a little bit angry.
The problem with AIDS is that it becomes like a religion. So, I mean, there are multiple groups and there are multiple viewpoints. And I think what you've done is you've polarized it and put it in one viewpoint. So, having worked in the field and working in the field every day, I deal on a day to day basis with people who are HIV positive. So, if the hypothesis that it is a harmless virus for its truth, and if it's due to malnutrition, as you say, what we do when we diagnose positive is we really make sure that the people that are diagnosed positive get all the nutritional that they need, they get all those things looked at, because we acknowledge that poverty and that kind of thing play a role. So, when their CD4 count gets down to about 20, and they really, really ill, so ill that they cannot attend as well, we put them on antiretrovirals, know that they're side effects and that they're not the answer. And a month later, that student is back in the class, having gained 4 kilos of weight, having lost all the signs of these other diseases that come with it. So I have to then have someone disprove to me what has happened here. I'm giving them food, I'm giving them, looking after those needs. So I think there are many sides to the problem. And I think to polarize it does an injustice to this problem, because nobody in Africa at the moment is stupid enough to think that you can address this without looking at social, economic and social political issues. We are looking at that. And I mean, to say that TB is a disease of poverty, you have to treat TB as well, and you know that it's related to poverty. And it is interrelated. All of these things seem to be interrelated. But I need to look at all sides of the picture. The problem is we can't talk to each other because people make it into a religion. So it must be there'll be two different religions speaking to them, and you can't debate it because then it becomes a belief system. So unfortunately, although you make valid points, I don't like the fact that it's been polarized into two different religions. There are different viewpoints, and one needs, and if Duisberg so believes in what he said, then one needs to ask him, if it's a harmless virus, would he take somebody's blood, which is proved to have the HIV virus in it, seeing that it doesn't cause anything?
Well, I would do. 15 years ago, Peter Duisberg said, I would inject myself with sample of HIV from anybody's lab but Robert Gallo. I think, yes, And I don't have any qualms with it. I do genuinely believe that HIV is not the cause of AIDS. But I really think it's very interesting. It's like when I go into teacher class and I talk about underdevelopment, and I talk from a political economy point of view and I'm critical of the World Bank, and somebody says, aren't you going to give a kind of balanced picture and give us the World Bank side and give us your side? And I say, no, but it took 25 years for me to get here, where I have an opportunity to give you my point of view. You get the other point of view every day. You get it on CNN, you get it in the New York Times. I don't have to be balanced. I'm rectifying a gross imbalance. I think it's very unfair to say that I have polarized the situation and that we have two religions. You're talking about a handful of dissidents, like Peter and Carrie Mullis and a few others, and I gratefully regard myself as one, but hardly in their class, a small group of dissidents who barely get listened to, who don't get research funding for the projects and hypotheses that they put forward, against the whole range of the medical establishment, including the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And you say there are two religions in the situation polarized. This is not a polarization among equals. This is a highly asymmetrical, power-based set of differences. Let me give you a good example. Carrie Mullis, in writing about, he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his invention of the polymerase chain reaction. One of such a great discovery that he was one of the few Nobel laureates who doesn't have to wait till he's a doddering octogenarian to get his summons to Stockholm. And he went on to work for a private research institution, and they said, can you write a grant proposal? And it involved talking about AIDS. And so as a scientist, he went on to say, where is the original publication that says that HIV causes AIDS? It doesn't exist. It was Robert Gallo in the Center for Disease Control that gave a press conference. That's not good science. Science begins with peer-reviewed publication of your work to be tested and looked at and examined by other scientists. That's not how it happened with HIV. There was no original test. There were no original publications in peer-reviewed journals. It was a public relations gesture that a political solution had to be found to this gay disease in the United States. And that's how the CDC announced it. And for many, many years thereafter, there was no basic attributable source for that except Robert Gallo, who later got almost convicted of fraud by his profession.
Thank you. Jan?
Yeah. I feel slightly uncomfortable, I must say. Before I said we should be able to live with different discourses, and I still believe that, but I also think we should, for analytical purposes, be able to keep discourses separate, see that they function within different domains. And there's some of the confusion that I feel in the current discussion that we are mixing the discourse of politics, for instance, with the discourse of science. I agree with much of what I heard. I agree with the value of dissidence. But it doesn't mean the fact that if we draw particular scientific conclusions, like those that are currently dominant, it doesn't mean that they are wrong, because the World Bank, for instance, shares them. And somehow it transpires. I don't say it's your intention to say that, but
yeah,
it transpires from the dialogue that we are supposed to be more on our guards when the World Bank adopts a particular view and a particular scientific vision coincides with that. I think we should always be on our guards, whoever supports us. I agree, certainly, that there's a lot of interference of the power structure with what happens in science, the way that science develops. There's certain things that happen, there are things that do not happen, and I feel great sorry that is the reality in our world. There would be less weapons industry and there would be more industry for many other good purposes. That's the reality, and I think we should indeed criticize that. But again, we shouldn't mix the discourses of the power issue with the discourse of science. I hope I'm clear.
Sorry.
Just my general impression of your presentation is
Cheryl and then John.
Well, I just, then obviously there is a comfort in the burden when you do it, and yet when we talked about what is, how do we see the times to come, a lot of our conversations in the early days here were to put it in the context of economic, politics, and religion, which could be enhancers or impediments to the times moving forward. And I think that this is kind of a conversation we have to ask somebody that we really do not know the solution. So the discussion is exactly doing what we described as trying to find that there is today in the context of things, commercial, political, religious, and other values. We're really trying to find a way to say why, not knowing ethically and always what is the right solution. So why I would disagree with some of Eric's points in the case of
just a question of clarification. Would you say that a clinical case of tuberculosis could occur in the absence of the tuberculosis facilities? And would you say that AIDS could occur in the absence of the
so does the Center for the Center for Disease Control says that as well. There are, if you read the New England Journal of Medicine and the Lancet, there are articles written all the time about AIDS in the absence of HIV. And the only thing is that the Center for Disease Control prefers not to call it AIDS in the absence of HIV. They give it a totally new name so that it doesn't look as if it is critical of the HIV AIDS model. But in fact, immune deficiency, it has been traced back by various writers, documented at least into the 19th century, of immune suppression. We all know that there are many causes of immunodeficiency. You can be born, we all know the story of the boy in the bubble. You can get, it can be genetic. It can be the result of certain diseases produce a collapse of the immune system. It can be overload from a variety of things. Duisberg's argument with regard to gays was overload of drugs like poppers and antibiotics and other things. Many things can lead to immune deficiency.
But then isn't it a semantic question? Because one gives the name HIV AIDS to immunodeficiency syndrome in the presence of the HIV virus.
Yeah.
And one could give a different name to tuberculosis if it ever occurred in the absence of the bacillus.
That might be true. I mean, it may be, as I said, for example, with Burkitt's lymphoma, one may well go in that direction that there is Epstein-Barr virus, there is malaria, and there's also sometimes both and sometimes none implicated. I think that the notion of disease causality is actually becoming patently much more complicated.
The adjective acquired, then, is essential. Is it acquired?
Well, there is a major distinction that was known before AIDS, per se. It's in the Merck manual going back 30 years, that you can have congenital immune deficiency, genetically based. You can have acquired, but getting it through malnutrition is acquired. Right.
Yeah, in another sense.
Yeah. Having said that,
Well, that seems to me to be a pretty good wrap-up comment, Mary. And I'd like to thank Eric and Jill and Suzanne for actually getting us going, and I hope that we can continue that after winning.
Thank you, Ron, for facilitating. It's time for coffee. After coffee, we'll be back here for a half-hour recording session to find out where the different groups stand. An intermediate recording brief for each of the groups, because tomorrow, in the final session, we have some summary reporting on those various findings. So, coffee for now.